The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is Duray, and welcome to Pod Save the People. In this episode, we have Mirsa Baradaran, one of the leading experts on closing the racial wealth gap in the country. We also have David Kamen, former special assistant to President Obama for economic policy. And we have the news with me, Brittany, Clint, and Sam, as always. Before we get started, I'll just say that I'm reminded that it's important that we are as organized on the inside as we are on the outside. And I think about that because of the historic wins that we had on the left just a week ago. And while it's important that we press on the outside, that has to be a part of the work, that we force systems and structures to respond. It is also important that there are people who already understand equity, who already understand justice, who already understand the world that we should have and want to build that. So this is not about either or, this is about both and. Let's go. And now the news with me, Brittany Pagnett, former member of the Ferguson Commission, appointed by President Obama to the task force in 21st century policing, and now a leader in education. Clint Smith III, our resident academic, and Samuel Sinyangwe, our resident data scientist.
It's the news. This is Brittany Pagnett at Ms. Pacchetti on all social media.
And this is Sam Sinyangwe at Sam Sway on Twitter.
What's going on, y'all? This is Clint Smith at Clint Smith III. Clint Smith III for old school sake.
And this is Duray at Duray, D-E-R-A-Y, on Twitter.
So shout out to everyone who went and voted. If you were in one of the about third of the country states that had elections last Tuesday, as we discussed on the pod.
Yeah, you know, Democrats got a bunch of unexpected surprises, especially in Virginia, flipped more than a dozen House seats in their favor. And you know, it was I almost forgot what it felt like to not be consumed in a spiral of despair. So it was a pleasant surprise to get some notifications saying that, you know, Northam had won. And you know, I was really, like most folks, super excited about those down ballot results. And you know, we have to be careful and certainly not make too much of it. But it's heartening. And I think that we have to give ourselves a moment to celebrate and say that good stuff was done. But also, obviously, the additional work begins now. You know, it's about holding folks accountable after you elect them. And so I hope that everybody who went out and voted for Democrats and got these folks elected also does the work of holding their feet to the fire and saying that you have an obligation to represent us and our interest, and you should be held accountable to the standards that you espoused for yourself when you were running.
Yeah, it's interesting, Clint, you mentioned, you know, feeling this air of despair being lifted. I felt sort of the same way. It almost felt after the past year that, like, it was hard to imagine that our votes could actually, like, make a difference and elect folks. I remember after, you know, in Georgia, I think it was Georgia 6 with Ossoff running, and then he didn't win, and there was so much energy about it. I think now it's been clearly demonstrated that the enthusiasm is on the Democrat side and on the, you know, let's actually hold and the Republicans accountable for everything that they've done over the past year and more. And then it was sort of a split feeling because on the other side, you see what happened in the Virginia House of Delegates where, you know, Democrats won, I think it was like 54% of the vote, but didn't get a majority of seats. It was like 50-50. Because of gerrymandering. So, you know, we have to be vigilant. One, our votes matter. And two, the more that we can get folks elected who are not rigging the game in favor of the Republicans, the better those outcomes will be.
As a reminder, there is a special election coming up in Alabama. And if you don't know, there's basically a predator on the ballot. So that election is in December. And then our 2018 midterm elections, there are 33 U.S. Senate seats up. Every single one of the 435 U.S. House seats are up for election. 198 state executive seats. So that's governors, state superintendents of education, state attorneys, et cetera. Over 6,000 state legislature seats. That doesn't even include all of the judges, city councils, mayors, et cetera, that will be up to vote on Election Day 2018. So get out there, use that momentum to keep going.
And just so we can go over the victories, Braxton Winston won on the city council in Charlotte, North Carolina. He is a protester. The first mayor of Framingham, Massachusetts, Yvonne Spicer, a Black woman. She's the first mayor in the history of Framingham. The town just voted recently to become a city instead of a town government. The first Black female mayor of Charlotte, her name is Mayor-elect Vi Lyles. Her father didn't graduate from high school. She spent 3 decades as city administrator before running for office. The first Black mayor of Statesboro is Jonathan McCollar. The first Black mayor of Cairo, Georgia, is Booker Gaynor. The first Black mayor of Midgeville, Georgia, is Mary Parham Copeland. First Black mayor of Georgetown, South Carolina, Brendan Barber. The first Black mayor of Helena, Montana, Wilmot Collins. And the first Black mayor of St. Paul, Minnesota, Melvin Carter. He was on Potty of the People. The first Latina is elected to the Virginia House of Delegates, Democrats Elizabeth Guzman and Hala Alaya. The first Asian American female to be elected to the Virginia House of Delegates is Kathy Tran. And then there were two transgender elected officials, Danica Rome and Andrea Jenkins, who both were elected. Andrea Jenkins was the first Black transgender woman to be elected into public office when she won the Minneapolis City Council race. And then Danica won in Virginia. So Felipe Cunningham, who's a transgender man who won in Minneapolis as well. A lot of big wins, and it's important that we celebrate those wins.
And to your point, Britt, about the momentum and the special election happening in Alabama, just to be, 100% clear, this election is between an alleged pedophile and a man who prosecuted the Ku Klux Klan after the four little girls were killed in Birmingham, Alabama, a few decades ago. And so, in terms of the sort of moral standing of these two individuals, it's pretty much no contest, but it is going to certainly be a test of the moral consistency of a lot of evangelicals in Alabama and the sort of political infrastructure of Alabama writ large. And it's been wild, to put it euphemistically, to see so many people sort of hula hoop their way to all these different defenses of him, of Roy Moore, of a really indefensible thing to do.
Well, this is also a big day because this is Brittany's birthday. Hey. Brittany turned 33 today. Whoop, whoop, whoop.
Oh, I just heard Baby J telling me happy birthday. Tell him thanks.
Say happy birthday.
Thanks, y'all.
Hey, happy birthday, Brittany.
Where are you, Brittany? How are you celebrating your birthday?
I've been in Manchester in the UK for the last few days for a fellowship. So I should probably stop my terrible accent now. Everybody's been very kind. And
it's pretty awful.
It wasn't terrible. That's good.
B-.
But, I've felt really honored to...
I was just in England trying to go around with an accent and it really did not work.
People were like, nope.
No, Brittany.
Shut it down.
Brittany Noel Packnett. That was a pretty bad accent.
Is it Barrington?
There's a guest here.
Brittany Noel, is that you?
Hi, Bear. Oh, my God. You guys.
Happy birthday, Brittany.
This is Brittany's brother.
Hey, buddy.
Bear, can you please tell us some interesting fact about Brittany Noel Packnett that the world does not know yet?
Oh, no.
I think the best little known fact about my sister is actually, if she wasn't doing what she's currently doing, she was destined for a career in comedy. She's by far one of the funniest individuals I know.
She is.
Oh, man.
She's pretty shady, too. She has like some good shady lines that are actually hilarious.
Oh, absolutely. She got that from her mother. She'll throw some shade at you and you won't know it hit you till a month later.
Did Brittany have any nicknames growing up?
Oh, yeah. What level of embarrassment am I allowed to give my sister on this?
You got to turn it up to 100.
Just want the truth.
Okay, we'll go 0 to 100 real quick. Brittany, let's see. So we'll start with everybody, the one everybody knows, which is BB, because I was, when I was born, I thought Brittany was too long and I couldn't say it. So BB came from that. Let's see, though. But it got more interesting from there. We had Big Head. Dang. We had Doom Buggy.
Doom Buggy? It's not a good birthday without a surprise, Brittany.
Well, this was a really wonderful surprise. Nope, time to stop talking. Love you.
I love
you.
Oh,
snap. Bye.
Well, Bear, thanks so much for joining us. And Brittany, we love you. And you're an incredible friend and partner on everything.
I love y'all too. Thanks, Bear.
No problem. Love you. Happy birthday again.
I love that he thought that everybody just knew your name was BB. Like, we didn't call you BB, but now I got you, BB.
Oh, God. Oh, gosh. That was a close-held family nickname. And now I'm going to have people walking up to me on the street like, BB, I just heard you on Pod Save the People.
I love it. We got I and BB.
Oh, man. That was really sweet, you all. Thank you for including my brother. He's an incredible person and minister, and he's just a real shining light in my life. So it was such a wonderful surprise to hear his voice. So thank you all for that.
Okay, the news.
My piece of news, actually two articles, two studies that have come out. One from Patrick Sharkey, who previously has done some great work around concentrated poverty and the effects of concentrated poverty by race. And now has come out with a study which looks at the impact that nonprofit organizations have had on the crime rate. And so he looks at, I think it's a 230 or 270 cities for the past few decades, and looks at the number of nonprofit organizations that are doing community-based work, particularly focused on safety and economic and youth development, and finds that they had a dramatic impact on the reduction of the crime rate that we saw over the past several decades. In particular, every 10 additional community-based organizations was associated with a 6% reduction in violent crime and a 9% reduction in the murder rate. And so this is really, really important when you put it in context of some of the other strategies that have been used during that period to address crime, mainly policing and incarceration. So a study from the Brennan Center came out that looked at the declining crime rates over the past several decades and the impact, if any, that policing and incarceration and a variety of other factors had on it. What they found was that mass incarceration had no impact on the violent crime rate, and policing, adding more police officers to the force, had between 0 and 5% impact on the violent crime rate. And so, again, 0 to 5%. So it might not have had an impact. It might have had a very small impact. But when you look at those two strategies, they're about $180 billion a year. The Prison Policy Institute came out with a study that looked at how much money the system of mass incarceration and policing costs. It's about $180 billion a year that are being spent on that strategy, which again has no impact compared to a strategy of investing in community organizations and community-based work, which actually has a greater impact and gets much less investment than those other strategies. So I bring that first study into the conversation. And then the second study that came out looked at Medicaid and found that the expansion of Medicaid, particularly the substance abuse treatment that was associated with that, also had an impact in reducing crime rates. So it reduced rates of robbery, aggravated assault, and larceny theft in communities with a cost-benefit ratio of between 1.8 and 3.2. So what both of these studies do is they add to a growing body of evidence that shows quite clearly that investing in community-based approaches, approaches that are giving people access to healthcare and other resources that they need, are much more effective than more punitive approaches of policing and incarceration and denying people benefits at addressing the issue of crime.
So, you know what I really love about this, and I appreciate you bringing this piece of good news to the pod, Sam, not just because it's another place for us to find hope and momentum, but because it proves some prevailing myths and rhetoric absolutely incorrect. So as folks who have become known for protesting police violence, the refrain is often that we don't care about community violence, right? That, you know, and the line is often thrown out there, well, what about how many people are killed in Baltimore? What about how many people are killed in Chicago? And here's what this tells me. This tells me that not only is that false, because folks every day in our communities, as we have always known, are fighting the good fight and putting everything that they can into making their neighborhood safe and whole and healthy. But they're actually doing a better job at it than well-funded police departments. In Chicago, the city council just decided to approve a $90+ million new police academy. And many people, including Chance the Rapper, but also lots of on-the-ground activists, had been doing a lot of work to oppose this while schools are shutting down and while community organizations like the ones that you're talking about, Sam, are making a real difference in the community. And so if we actually made the kind of investments in the people who are getting results and in the people living in our communities to do this work, instead of folks who continue to show themselves to not be responsible and not be held accountable when they violate our democracy and constitutional rights, I believe we'd see a lot of great progress. So this really turns a lot of the prevailing ideologies about how to do this work on its head. And I'm really hoping that that everyone from private philanthropists to cities with public funding will think about this study and will use it to inform their future actions.
So this paper is definitely really important and confirms a lot, as you said, Brittany, of what we have known to be happening in so many of our communities across the country for a very long time. And that, you know, recreational basketball leagues and that urban gardens and that, you know, providing dance classes and community centers. We know that these are not simply recreational activities, but these are in fact activities that are tied to a reduction in crime, and that these are activities that folks in communities are purposefully working on with the intention of keeping so many of the young people in those communities up to things that don't give them the opportunity to fall into the trap or lead them on a trajectory to do something harmful with their time. And it also reminds me of Elizabeth Hinton's book that I've mentioned on the podcast before, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime. And a lot of what she talks about is how so many of these communities, when crime was rising, so many of the police departments and governments, when crime was rising, they invested kind of singularly in expanding the police state, expanding the surveillance state. And what she contends is that it is more important to be investing in people in communities who have organizations and who have autonomy over the way that their organizations operate. Because, you know, as we often say, it is one thing for other folks to have an idea of what a community needs or what they, you know, believe or what their you know, their scales and their models have told them about what's most important in the community. But no one knows a community like the folks who are there and who have been there for generations. No one is invested in the community like they are. And like you said, Brittany, you know, it is important that we don't discount that. And it's important that we recognize that folks are both protesting against violence at the hands of the state and also doing the important and often overlooked work every single day of pushing back against community violence in the face of like decades of history and systems and structures that makes that work incredibly difficult.
I think about two things. One is that when systems fail people, people in communities always step up, and that in stepping up, there's an impact. And this is a great example of like systems and structures in all of the cities they measured in some ways have failed people in marginalized communities, poor people, Black people. And what you see is these community-based organizations stepping up and providing that infrastructure to make sure that people have the resources they need, have the support they need, have the learning and love that they need. And finally, there are studies that prove that and show that that's worthy. We always know it in communities, but it's important that it's in the literature. The second thing I think about is how sometimes the corrective action that people think about is something that'll have immediate results, even if the results like don't actually make sense. So Like, I think a lot of people want there to be more police in communities just because they, like, get it. It's like, more police, that must be less crime, da-da-da. And it's like, even if it has no impact, that's like, people are just okay with that. When you're, like, investing literacy in a city, that feels so far-fetched and so, like, abstract to people that they don't, like, I think it's hard. People just don't think about those things in that way. And this is a great reminder that even if we can't measure it in the same way, like, we can actually think about the impact that it has. And we can talk about the benefit of that. And it is interesting that, like, mass incarceration didn't really change anything. But you see things like Medicaid, and it makes sense. It's like healthier people, like people with more resources and more options, like, are less likely to commit crimes. Like, that's not like a wild theory, but it's important that it's in the literature now.
So a big study from the Vera Institute was just released this past week, which evaluated the New York Immigrant Family Unit Project, which pioneered universal representation for detained impoverished immigrants in deportation proceedings, and showed a successful outcome rate of 48%, which is astonishing because it's up from just a 4% success rate for cases that did not have attorneys in that same court. And so it's difficult to overstate how big of a finding this is, that with guaranteed legal representation, up to 12 times as many immigrants have been able to win their cases, either able to get relief from deportation or at least able to persuade ICE to drop attempts to deport them this time. And Dara Lynn at Vox has been doing some really incredible reporting on this for weeks and honestly for years. And so for context, there's no right to counsel in an immigration court, which is part of the executive branch rather than the judiciary. And sometimes a person might get lucky and come across a pro bono legal aid clinic or attorney who can help them when they're in the courthouse. But that's unlikely. And the problem is that representation for detainees is often far beyond what they're able to afford. And additionally, imagine not being able to understand the language of the court proceedings happening around you, which is the case for many of the immigrants who come through these courts. And if you don't know the language, you have no way of knowing if you're eligible for so many of the protections that these courts offer, such as the Conventions Against Torture, the Violence Against Women Act, and special immigrant juvenile status that is often afforded to folks who are seeking asylum or who are seeking opportunities to have the courts and have the United States allow them to stay. But if you don't have an attorney, it really limits your ability to even know where to start and know if you qualify for any of those. And as you can imagine, our friend Jeff Beauregard Sessions is super frustrated with this and does not agree. And in a speech recently, he said that these were dirty, quote, dirty immigration lawyers who were dragging out cases and warned that the federal government would be taking action soon. So this is really important. And the fact that immigrants who are given access to an attorney have 12 times a better chance at winning their cases than before is pretty remarkable. And this is really going to be an incredible opportunity and test to see to what extent this may serve as a precedent for other cities across the country. And the cities in the network that have taken this upon themselves with the help of Vera are Atlanta, Georgia, Austin, Texas, Baltimore, Maryland, Chicago, Columbus, Ohio, Dane County, Wisconsin, Oakland, California, Prince George's County, Maryland, Sacramento, California, San Antonio, Texas, and Santa Ana, California. And so we'll certainly be keeping an eye on this. I'm sure that Vera will be continuing to do really rigorous research work on this as they have done. Shout out to the folks at Vera. But this is, again, you know, in a week of relative good news, this is more good news. And amid the difficulties of the federal government's sort of doubling down on really draconian immigration policy, this represents a really huge opportunity to make sure that folks are being protected and that they're getting the due process that they deserve.
So this study was really powerful in reading through it because it found that the rate at which folks were successful in defending immigrants who are at risk of deportation went from 4% all the way up to 48% was the estimate when legal defense was provided. And so, you know, this program is so powerful, potentially, you know, defending half of being successful in half of all cases. And I think about efforts at the state level and by some cities, you know, just most recently in California, they passed a state budget that included $45 million for immigrant legal defense. And I think, you know, ultimately that is, it's proving to be a very effective strategy and something that cities and states should invest more in to make sure that everybody, especially folks at risk of being deported, have access to legal counsel.
Brittany?
This is definitely some good news, but Clint, there are a couple of things that you said and that the article talks about that jump out at me. One, for Beauregard to call anybody dirty is the most astronomical level of disgusting irony I've ever heard. So I just wanted to get that out of the way because let's not forget his track record. But speaking of him and this administration, one of the things that they point out in this report is that a more just and equitable immigration court might not necessarily mean a more efficient one. And this administration has put a very high level of import on things being efficient. So this is a teachable moment for folks. If when you get a chance, go Google white middle-class dominant culture. Well, you will find the first or second response should link you to a PDF document that is multiple pages that essentially outlines what white middle-class dominant culture is. Now, what you have to remember is that the issue is not in and of these practices themselves. The issue is that these ways of being are dominant. They do not allow for other cultural practices or ways of being to be viewed as successful or right or righteous. So one of the tenets of white middle-class dominant culture is efficiency, and efficiency above all else. And so this is, I think, this finding presents another opportunity for us to put the will behind the politicians if they won't develop it themselves, to choose people over efficiency. That is what equity and liberation looks like, to choose people over efficiency, to choose justice over what's expedient, to choose what's right over what's fast.
I don't have anything to add about this specific issue. I think you're right. The study is so clear about the right to counsel, like, benefits people immensely. It makes me think about, though, the lack of public defenders across the country and what happens when either there isn't really a public defender's office or when the public defender's office is severely underfunded. So you think about places like New Orleans, where up until recently in New Orleans, studies show that public defenders who were assigned to misdemeanor courts each had upward to 19,000 cases a year. And you're like, well, I don't even, is that really the right to counsel? Like, what does that actually look like when you haven't funded an office in a way to actually give people any sense of representation? And I do think that this is an underexplored area. I think that with regard to immigration, it's underexplored. And with regard to criminal defense in like district court and local courts, it's something that like we take for granted because we've seen on TV that everybody has a lawyer. And in reality, like people actually don't have, we've not funded an infrastructure to guarantee people the right to counsel at scale.
Yeah. And to that point, DeRay, in some places you actually have to pay for a public defender. So like they'll have a public defender application fee and people will have to pay sometimes $50, sometimes $100 in order to actually get the public defender that they, you know, should be provided under the Constitution.
See, that's well.
So I wish I could continue the good news train here, but unfortunately I have some not so good news specifically around this issue of immigrations and refugees. So last Wednesday, the Trump administration abruptly canceled what's called the Central American Minors Program. That's minors as in children. It's called CAM for short. Essentially, this program was set up for young people in several Central American countries who are fleeing violence and have family that have legal status in the U.S. to apply for asylum. If those young people do not meet the standards of asylum, they can still receive what they call a temporary humanitarian parole, which allows you to stay in the country for 2 years. So this was created by the Obama administration in 2014 as at least a temporary solution to several refugee crises in countries that neighbor us just to the south. And in just the last 3 years, over 3,000 young people have come into this country either as asylum seekers or as people who received, again, that temporary humanitarian parole. That's their words, not mine. So the Trump administration had already slowed the program. But when they stopped it, there were 2,700 young people that were qualified for the parole program alone, who were just waiting on their travel information, who were all abruptly told that their acceptance had been revoked. And what we have to realize about this is not only is it cruel, applying for the program in the first place already puts you in grave danger. So if you are already living in dangerous or violent circumstances, you are often trying to stay in hiding and not draw attention to yourself. But the requirements of this program actually mean that you have to go and interview in person during daylight hours, right, during regular office hours, thereby drawing attention to yourself and taking a risk in the first place to even be able to seek this asylum in the United States. This once again proves that the policies of this administration, especially when it comes to immigration and receiving people across our borders, has nothing to do with the rhetoric that has been sold to the supporters of this administration. It has nothing to do with economics. It has nothing to do with crime and all of these other coded labels that get put on it. This is very simply about nationalism and hatred, period.
When I think about the program, you know, it was ended just days after the administration also ended the temporary protected status for Nicaraguans in the U.S., which is another immigration program that gave special immigration status to people from a foreign country where the U.S. had determined that the conditions in the home country prevented them from returning safely, or the country was unable to handle their return adequately. What I also think is sort of disgusting about this and so wild is that the critics of the Central American Minors Program, the program that Brittany referenced, one of their arguments for why the program should end was that they said the program didn't work because many of the applicants did not legally meet the definition of a refugee because they were fleeing violent conflict, but not persecution. And you're like, okay, like what? Like the Obama administration pushed back against that. They thought that was a ridiculous assertion. And they were like, we should have a program that allows people to seek asylum in the country. And for the right to say, well, you know what? They were running from violence, but it's not the persecution that we think is actually persecution, is so insulting. This is also an example of how this administration is dismantling things that are not making the national news every day, but are having a real direct consequence on people's lives. And the media has to figure out a way to talk about these things that are seemingly small pieces of news, but they're not small at all to the people they impact.
Duray, your comment about how they define persecution was fascinating and reminds me of the ways in which white supremacy continues to operate in guiding what the decisions are of our government and particularly this administration. And you know, you could see that in the way that they define persecution in a narrowly tailored way that, you know, will alienate or exclude large groups of people, predominantly people of color, who are fleeing violence and persecution. Like, who wouldn't call that persecution? You know, ultimately, I'm interested in seeing, how do they define persecution? And is there a way to actually update that? Did they change that definition? You know, or is it just arguing about how that's to be interpreted?
Yeah, no, you're right. The power to define is a huge power. And it is wild that you will contend that, like, they are fleeing deep violence, but it's just not persecution. And therefore, they shouldn't have access to the country. And like you said, Brittany, this is nationalism at its zenith, right? That like, this is as far as you can go with it. This is not a theoretical decision. This is one that has real life consequences. My news is a recent study that came out from Winthrop University. It's a study of residents in 11 southern states. The states are Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Virginia. And there were a couple findings that I thought were fascinating. 60% of Black people and just 19% of white people strongly think that the legacy of slavery and discrimination make it hard for Black people to work their way up. 46% of white people in these states say that white people are, quote, currently under attack. And when the statement racial minorities are currently under attack in this country, about 80% of Black people said that they agreed, and about 50% of white people said they agreed, which is interesting because white people overwhelmingly felt like they were under attack. So I brought this here because it is fascinating that it's like a debate topic, whether or not like slavery or enslavement had like still has a direct impact, or whether like racism still is real and has an impact on real people's lives. Like, I don't know what allows that to still be something that like is up for interpretation in this moment. So I'm fascinated by that, especially when we talk about some of the Southern attitudes and we think about even Roy Moore, how, and Sam, I know you tweeted this, and maybe you'll talk about this, but how that latest study shows that like evangelicals are more likely to support him now that it came out that he sexually abused a 14-year-old. And I just don't know where that comes from. It is fascinating that the studies are getting more granular and more precise with the language they use. But I worry about what happens that in 2017, like this stuff is even up for debate.
DeRay, when you talk about it being fascinating that these things are true or even up for debate, it is because in every single society, along every single identity line, the powerful will invent the narrative they need to preserve their power. So if you can get away from having to feel guilty about slavery because you never owned anyone, or if you can continue to perpetuate the idea that someone who is a Christian, that is the most important and defining characteristic that will make them a good legislator, irrespective of the fact that they are most likely a predator. You invent the story that you need to preserve the power that you want to have.
Yeah, Brittany, this reminds me, you know, when I was in 10th grade, I remember my AP US history teacher trying to tell the class that the Civil War was not about slavery and was about, I think she said, other economic concerns. Who knows what that is?
That's sort of wild.
Like some shadow economy that wasn't clearly happening in the United States. So yeah, what's fascinating to me is that these narratives are so powerful and enduring and widespread. You know, when you look at this polling that you shared, DeRay, you know, 46% of white people thought white people were under attack, and only 50% of white people thought that people of color were under attack. So it was pretty much the same proportion. And I think a big piece of this is that at every level, this is treated as sort of controversial and up for debate. I wonder, what are those things that can really sort of overcome or transcend that noise to convince people of the reality? Like, what are the most effective ways of doing that? And how do we do that, right? So, I think about studies that show that the places that had more enslaved people in 1860 predicted Trump support in 2016, right? And it's like, why is that, right? Like, this is so direct, like the legacy of enslavement and institutionalized oppression impacts everything. It structures everything that we see today. And there has to be a way, a process by which people can learn to identify that and associate that with its roots and its legacy. It's not happening in the schools by and large. I mean, some schools are doing it, but overall, that's not the curriculum that's taught. It's not happening by our elected officials, for sure. It's not happening in the media, where it's sort of treated as controversial and abstract. And I wonder sort of where that place will be that people actually can learn.
So, yeah, it feels like we go through this every few years, and in the last few years, increasingly so. I'm reminded of a great book by David Blight, who's a historian at Yale, I've mentioned before. He has a great book called Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory. And in it, he talks about how in 1860, the 4 million slaves in this country were worth more than all of the factories, railroads, and banks combined. And I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but I think it's really important for folks to understand that, to your point, Sam, about your teacher in high school, that there is no disentangling the economics of the United States in the 18th and 19th century from the reality of enslavement. And so there's that. And then secondly, I don't know if I've given this timeline before, so I apologize if I'm repeating myself, but like, the first slaves came to this country in 1619. The Emancipation Proclamation was signed in 1863. Civil War ended in 1865. Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act were 1964, 1965. So it has only been 50 years in which Black people in this country have even had a semblance of legal and legislative freedom. For 350 years prior to that, it was fundamentally legal for Black folks to be disenfranchised, dehumanized, delegitimized in the eyes of the state, not in an interpersonal, somebody being mean and using the N-word sort of way, but like, you are a state-sanctioned second-class citizen. So if you kick somebody for 350 years, and then you stop kicking them for a seventh of the amount of time that you kicked them, it would be morally and intellectually disingenuous to look at that person and say, why aren't you doing as well as me? Why don't you live in the same neighborhoods as me? Why don't you have the same jobs as me? Why is your health poorer than mine? But this is what we do in this country all of the time. We have this like deeply ahistorical conception of how we arrived at this moment. And the thing about racial inequality in this country is that it's actually not difficult to understand if you study the history that has led us to this moment. It is deeply unsettling, and it is deeply troubling, and will certainly make you will push back against the myopic notion of American exceptionalism. But like, I don't think that I put it in that timeline because I really don't think people consider the full scope of oppression that Black folks have experienced in the context of slavery and the disintegration of Reconstruction and Jim Crow. And and you know, there's one could make obviously a really compelling argument that there continue to be, and there are a myriad of more insidious manifestations of that oppression. But even if we were going to pretend that inequality ended in 1965 with the Voting Rights Act, the idea that would the 350 years prior would not impact the way that our country looks today is I don't even know what to say about it. It's laughable. But here we are.
Clint, why do you think, and Brent, everybody, why do you think these ideas still show up in the polls? Do you think that people are like, that white people are like just lying, that they're like choosing to believe a narrative they know to be untrue? Do you think, Sam, that it's like people aren't being taught the truth? I find it hard in 2017 where like the access to information is at an unprecedented high, that like almost 50% of white people in those 11 states think that they're being persecuted, or like that's so wild to me.
If you look at where they're getting their information, I think that's the message predominantly that they're receiving, right? If you know, what TV are they watching? Well, probably like Fox News. And all day, every day, Fox News is about, you know, is trying to create this narrative that white people, you know, white, you know, heterosexual, Christian men in particular, but people in general are being persecuted by this, that, and the other thing. That's the narrative, right? That's being pushed. It's the narrative being pushed by the president. It's the narrative being pushed in many different places, right? In our cultural sort of, in the cultural channels whereby they get their information, even on social media with the echo chambers. And so I think, you know, the question is, how do you disrupt that? You know, what would get the message through to people who have never been exposed to that, that, you know, something's different? And how would they even interpret that in a way that change their opinion? You know, you think about Roy Moore and so many evangelicals who particularly white evangelicals that have taken this moral high ground about behave all kinds of things that they think are, you know, sinful or whatever. But pedophilia, suddenly when it comes against their guy, right, Roy Moore, suddenly it's fake news and they don't even believe it and they want to vote for him even more, right? And so I don't know how you break through that. That's a great question for a sort of psychologist, social psychologist.
I also just wonder how much of this is about an even subconscious desire to abdicate yourself of responsibility, right? That in this particular context, holding on to, or rather creating a victim status in this particular context, allows you to escape any sense of responsibility or ownership for any of the problems in the world. And that's what you need to hold on to when you benefit from the way that the world is currently structured.
And I think it's, you know, it's just this idea of people's place in this country being questioned, right? If the pretense is that the reason that you have what you have is predicated on the fact that it was taken away or never given to a range of other demographics of people, and that the reason you are able to maintain a certain type of social and economic status in this country is because others took so much away from groups of people throughout the course of history, then it becomes, if somebody is suggesting to you that what you have or who you are is not sort of inherently deserved, I think it brings up real uncomfortable questions of identity, of people's sense of self and who they have told themselves who they are throughout their lives. And I want to be clear that, like, I think that, you know, if you want to generalize it, I think there are two groups. I think that there is a group of people who, no matter what empirical evidence or historical data you present them with, they will believe what they're going to believe. And there's nothing that will remove them from believing a set of erroneous ideas, regardless of how hard we seek to like combat them. And then I also think that there is a group of people in this country who just don't know. And again, we've talked about this before, but like, it is not to say that moving from naivete to knowledge means that it will necessarily change your action. But I also think that there are so many people in this country who don't know so much of this country's history. And education is not.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food. And before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Did you know that parents rank teaching financial literacy as the toughest life skill? That's where Greenlight comes in, the debit card and money app made for families. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and track spending with real-time notifications. Kids learn how to earn, save, and spend responsibly, while parents have peace of mind knowing smart money habits are being built with guardrails in place. Try Greenlight risk-free today at greenlight.com/trygreenlight. That's greenlight.com/trygreenlight.
At all going to singularly fix or alleviate the very real and different material realities in this country, but I don't think that we can overstate the extent to which so many folks in this country really are presented their entire lives with such a narrow conception of what American history is and who's benefited from it.
That's the news. Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
And now my conversation with Mirza Baradarian, one of the leading scholars on closing the racial wealth gap, and also the author of a new book, The Color of Money, Black Banking and the Racial Wealth Gap.
So Professor Mirza Baradarian, thank you so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I have been looking forward to this conversation on the podcast because it's one of the topics that is arguably the most important in terms of scaled solutions, but it just doesn't enter into the public conversation much. And that's, how do we close the racial wealth gap and what that looks like at scale? Can you talk about how you stumbled across, or how this became the issue that would take your life's work?
Yeah, so I am a banking law scholar, and I spent, you know, years working as a banking law person on Wall Street, and I've written books about banking, and this is my field. And I stumbled across sort of black banks and, you know, looked into their history and realized that these institutions are able to say more about the racial wealth gap than any other institution. And so tracking their history really sort of, you know, outlines how the racial wealth gap was created and how efforts to fight it, what those efforts to fight the racial wealth gap, which black banks have been engaged in since the Civil War, tell us about how sticky the racial wealth gap is. And I think you're absolutely right. This racial wealth gap underlies everything. It's not this like burning fire, like, you know, police brutality and all of this stuff. And so it doesn't sort of command the attention that these other actions do. But I think it bleeds into everything, and it really causes so much underlying injustice. So many of the other injustices that we do talk about that really get public attention, I think, stem from this tragedy of the fact that the racial wealth gap is so large, it has not closed, and it's actually growing. I mean, we just have not improved on this since the Civil War.
Now, I read the study, The Race to Zero, that talks about that in 2053, I believe, that the racial The median income for Black people would be $0 in this country.
And the wealth statistics are even worse. We talk about income, but when we're dealing with wealth, I mean, a third of Black families have zero to negative wealth.
Right now?
Yes. Yes. A third of Black families have zero to negative wealth. And the averages are dramatic as well. So average, you know, with a college degree, white households have something like 360,000 on average. Black families have something like 30,000. So across every income level and every education level, whites have something like 20 times more wealth than Blacks. So it's not just there's more concentrated poverty. You know, it works out across every income and education level.
Now, how would you describe to people the difference between income and wealth? I think what most people think about this income is like what their gut goes to.
Yeah. So income is, it's a reliable indicator when you're talking about sort of upward mobility. But wealth is much more central when we're talking about a community's access to resources. So our U.S. tax code is sort of a local tax code. So your schools, your local resources are funded through property taxes. So this is where wealth has this sneaky ability to limit resources across the board for communities. So low wealth communities, you have just low capital and low property ownership. And so this means that your schools are crappier, right? This means that your resources, you just don't have the social capital, the industry in your neighborhoods. And wealth ends up becoming a predictor for income. So in other words, it's not as though high income or low income leads to low wealth. It's that low wealth leads to low income. So in other words, if you have low wealth to begin with, and this tracks back to housing usually, right? So, you know, the way the middle class, the way we measure middle class wealth is through housing. And so Blacks have been, you know, deprived of these housing initiatives by the federal government. We can talk about that later. But what this means when you have low wealth is that you have, you know, worse schools. You have lower sort of social infrastructure. You have lower just infrastructure, and the ladders out of those communities are restricted. And so you've got these low wealth communities, and that leads to lower education opportunities, lower college attendance. And when you don't own your home, you're less likely to be able to get a student loan to go to a good college. You're more likely to be able to be, you know, succumb to, you know, predatory lending and debt. Black communities are taken to court more for their, you know, debts than white communities. It just kind of, you know, becomes this cycle of debt and lack of opportunity. And this is directly related to wealth and not income.
Now, when I talked to some people about this, and I just actually got an email from a young person today, who his argument was sort of like, DeRay, I hear you talk about this stuff and it feels divisive that he's a white young man and he's like, you know, I get that there was wrongdoing, but when you try and say that like the system is against people, you know, we've come so far since slavery and people just need to work hard. That was sort of like his gist. What do you say to people who are like, well, everything's equal now. And because things are equal now, like we should move on. Like, what's your response to that as a historian and as somebody who studied these issues so deeply?
The past is very much with us. I mean, this is we don't even have to go back to slavery. I mean, the economic disparities, Black and white, you know, there was obviously slavery, and then there was, you know, a century of Jim Crow laws. But then there was a New Deal era in actions, which I've talked about and outlined in my book, where, you know, everyone's grandfather, when they came back from World War II, if they were white, they got this FHA mortgage. They got a GI Bill that allowed them to go to school. And that affects what your opportunities are if you're white today, right? We're not going back to slavery today. If your grandfather or your, you know, father had, you know, came from a family that owned a home, you just started off with much more access to resources, right? So if you get a hiccup, you can move back to your parents' house. You can get a loan derived from that house. If you're Black, you did not get those mortgages. The FHA decided to not give mortgages to Black communities. I mean, this was explicit. The one marker for what communities were deemed too risky to give mortgages to was the racial makeup of that community. So if you were Black and you lived in a Black neighborhood, you could not get a mortgage. And then you couldn't move into another neighborhood because the white communities restricted your ability to purchase because through these racial covenants. And so Black people got stuck in these communities, these low wealth, low property, low opportunity communities, and whites were able to go to the suburbs and these high opportunity communities. And that is very much with us today. We are still in those areas of segregation. So you still, you know, looking at the red lines that the FHA created in 1934, the racial makeup has not changed. And so this is not about, oh, like, we're talking about slavery. Why are we talking about that now? We're on equal footing. We are not on equal footing. And the racial wealth gap, I think, is where past injustices really have present consequences. And this is why I choose to focus on the racial wealth gap and not talk about sort of just, you know, discrimination. Because I think discrimination is, obviously there is plenty of discrimination, but the racial wealth gap is really where history has this sneaky and real tragic event effect on communities that is really easy to look away from. But I think this is where we need to look very, very closely, looking at the economic factors, which is what I've done in the book, looking at the institutions that were created. So we're not talking about, you know, implicit bias. I'm not talking about anything like that. I'm looking at institutions, and I'm looking at how capital, once created through white wealth building institutions like the banks and like the home ownership programs, was able to perpetuate capital in white communities, and what that deprivation of capital and property ownership meant for Black communities. That is very much something that self-perpetuates without any need for added racism. So this is, you know, to your white friend and others who might challenge this idea, it's that, look, I mean, these institutions have way longer lasting effects than what you would assume. And these, you know, the you know, Black-white education gap, the Black-white crime gap, the Black-white, all of those gaps stem from very real historic policy decisions made by the federal government.
I've heard you before talk about the organizing that happened around economic injustice in the past, in that being one of your research areas. Can you talk about that a little bit? And how that's different than today, you would argue?
I think during the 1960s, so between, you know, toward the tail end of the civil rights era, I mean, from the beginning, right, 1963, you know, Martin Luther King launches the, before 1963, they launched the Montgomery bus boycotts. And from the beginning, I mean, before King starts the Montgomery bus boycotts, his, you know, 10-point or 15-point agenda for the movement has very much to do with economic policy. You know, his speech, his I Have a Dream speech, you know, we kind of cherry pick the quotes that we want, one of which that, you know, is a favorite among, you know, policymakers is, you know, judge me by the content of my character, not the color of my skin, being like this, oh, we're in this colorblind world. But Martin Luther King's message was very much about economic injustice. I mean, even in that I Have a Dream speech, he says, we've come here to, you know, our check is cashed, insufficient funds. You know, he's talking about it in terms of economic power and past injustice needing to be remedied. And so Martin Luther King, you know, as he, you know, after the civil rights laws are passed, he starts to launch this poor people's movement and, you know, is obviously assassinated before he can get it off the ground. But during this 1965 to 1969 era, Black activists are very much focused on economic reforms. You know, and there's disparities on how we want that to happen. So is it integration? Is it housing integration? Is it reparations? And these things were discussed in an open way, right? This idea was that we have been deprived these communities. The poverty is concentrated, and it's because of these federal policies and these Jim Crow laws. So we need not just to eradicate these laws, which is what the Civil Rights Act did. Everyone recognized this is incomplete until we remedy the problems of the past. And that kind of goes away. And I talk about how Nixon was able to sort of subvert this whole movement and talk about Black capitalism in a really sort of sneaky, sort of tricky dick way that he has of sort of, you know, flipping the table. And since that era, you know, post Nixon, we've got this sort of neoliberal free market talk, and now we just don't talk about the past injustices anymore. And we just assume that we're in this colorblind world and that the past injustices were wiped away as soon as the civil rights era laws were passed. But every principle of the civil rights era, including Nixon himself, who was not, you know, pro civil rights, understood that something had to be done to address poverty because that poverty was created through federal policy. And I think we forgot that. And we tend to have this amnesia when it comes to the injustices borne by the Black community. So I really don't think you have to, you know, go back very far to see this vibrant conversation that we just don't have anymore.
And what are the solutions? Is it financial literacy courses in high schools? Is it is it Black banks? Like, what is it? Talk about financial literacy. You know, I said that somewhere and I got an email from somebody that was like, you know, DeRay, we need financial literacy education. And I was like, I talked to an expert who told me something different. So can you talk about that?
Idea of financial education comes up. And look, I'm not saying that we don't need financial education. Everyone needs financial education. But when you hear financial education being directed at poor communities, there's this underlying assumption that people are poor because they make bad decisions or because they're not educated enough. They don't know enough about money, and that's why they're poor. And I just want to nip that in the bud and just be like, that is every bit of research that has ever been done on the wealth gap and on financial education shows that, in fact, poor people know much more about money management than do the wealthy. Why? Because they need that information more. There's been these studies where you get people outside of a grocery store. So you're coming out with your cart. You ask a middle-class person, how much did you spend in total? What was the price of each item in the cart? And they have no idea. They can't remember. Whereas a poor person knows exactly what they spent. So all of these other studies show that when you're dealing in scarcity, right, when you have less of a financial buffer, you're much more attuned to what things cost, to using your money. When people go to these payday lenders, it's not that they don't know the cost. It's not that education can help them here. It's that they have no other choice. I have no family that has wealth. My granddaddy doesn't have a home that I can borrow from. No one in my close circle of friends and family has $500 extra. My car broke down or my child is sick. I need this money, so I go to a payday lender. Financial education isn't really going to help me in this scenario. I need options. I need other alternatives besides these payday loans. And so financial literacy has become this sort of, you know, this thing that we throw at poor communities that is not proven to be the gap there. The gap is that they don't have enough money. It's not the lack of education. And so this, you know, and I think what it does, the harm I see in touting this is that it's a blame shifting thing, right? It's instead of saying, look, what are the global system-wide injustices that have created this gap? And then it instead of focusing on those things, it puts the burden on the individual decision maker and says, if you only could decide better, if you could only do things differently, right? This is this, then you wouldn't be so poor. I mean, I was at a Treasury conference on the racial wealth. It was on the Freedmen's Savings Bank, which is a bank I talk about in the book. But the Black Enterprise CEO was asking the Treasury Secretary, this is an Obama's Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew, and he says, you know, what do we do about this racial wealth gap? And the Treasury Secretary, you know, is like, oh, this is this huge wealth gap, and we're very concerned about it. And he says, well, let me tell you about, you know, when I was first starting out and, you know, I didn't have very much money. Mind you, he is a, you know, Ivy League educated, you know, very prominent Treasury Secretary. And he says, you know, what I did is I just saved my money, and maybe you don't buy lattes, and that's how you, you know, get your house. And that is just, I mean, it's completely the wrong way to look at this wealth gap. I mean, he just has no, there's not, you know, like, and I, you know, said at the time, like, tell me how many lattes you'd have to skip to close this racial wealth gap.
Right.
I mean, like, give me a number here, or like avocado toast. How many avocado toast should I not buy to make up for that FHA loan that my grandfather didn't get? You know, so this is not about, you know, saving money. In fact, the research shows that Blacks actually save more than whites. So it's not about individual decisions here. This is about systemic problems.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
Are payday loans the same things as cash checking? Like, what is, when people say, are they synonymous?
No. So cash checking, so if you don't have a bank account, right, so there's like 38 million Americans or more are underbanked or unbanked. And so way more blacks than whites are. So you don't have access to a bank account. This is because banks have left inner city neighborhoods and rural areas. So if you don't have a bank account, you go to a check casher to cash your checks. You then have to take that money and go and pay your bills, your water bill, your electricity bill, your phone bill. You go and you pay in cash. This is 10% of your income that goes to fees just to use your money. So this is just this tax on the poor. Payday loans are, if you have a bank account, you have a job, you just have a gap in what you make and what you need in expenses in 1 month, right? So a lot of poor people have income volatility, meaning that they have unpredictable schedules at work, right? Or if they have these costs that come up and they have no buffer of savings because they're just, you know, working at these low wage jobs, which is not paying people enough to live. And so let's say you're, you know, a single mom, and usually, you know, it's single moms that end up becoming the large majority of the poor who have to rely on these payday loans. So you have a single mom, let's say you work at Walmart, you know, your schedule is erratic. One, you know, month your kid gets sick or your kid needs, you know, school supplies or your car breaks down, you need $500. Your income just doesn't cover it. Your social circle doesn't have it. You don't want to get evicted from your home because that leads to a whole bunch of other problems. So you go to get a payday loan. You pay $500, you know, hoping that by the next month you can cover it. Now these loans, what they do, the interest just spirals out of control, right? So every 2 weeks you're paying $50 to $100 to service the loan. By the time it's all said and done, usually, you know, you've had the loan out for a couple of months, you paid $2,500 for that $500 loan.
Wow.
And you're in a whole world of trouble that you didn't have before. Now you're dealing with, you know, a court and could be bankruptcy, lots of stress, meanwhile, and the health consequences of that chronic stress. And this is something that those of us who are middle class and wealthy and have a buffer of savings just don't understand, the mental, physical, and financial toll that these payday lenders take on the, people's lives. And really, there are no other options. So, you know, if you're going to give financial education to that single mom, you would say, well, don't take out this loan. She would say, well, where do I get this $500? And you would say, go to friends and family, because that's how people end up paying these things off. And she would, you know, and have to find someone to pay for that. And a lot of people, if you are poor, your social circle is also poor. And so it's not a possibility. Banks don't lend those small amounts. And so, you know, it's a real, you can go to the black market and see, you know, maybe you have some loan shark in the neighborhood that will front you the money. And that's a whole other set of collection practices that those people engage in, like, you know, busted kneecaps and things like that. So, you know, this is a market that there's a demand for, and the payday lenders are the only ones meeting it.
Now, are black banks the solution? Like, when people talk about, you know, I've always been interested in when people talk about black banks, like, I'm all for it. I've been trying to figure out what makes a black bank different than like another bank. And is the solution that black people should be putting their money in black banks and communities? Or is that like just a proxy to get us somewhere else?
I think black banks are institutions that do not exploit black communities, and they do offer a lot of services that other banks don't offer. So I think black banks are great resources in a community. Are they the solution to the wealth gap? No. And I think this is important because ever since, you know, the cusp of the Civil War to today, policymakers, when black communities and activists, I mean, this goes back to Frederick Douglass, this goes to Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and all, you know, W.E. Du Bois, when they have asked policymakers for real, meaningful reforms on the economic agenda, policymakers have pushed back with black banks. So Reconstruction is a good example. You know, Reconstruction is, you know, we were going to get, the blacks were going to get 40 acres and a mule. This is the land that they had been working for hundreds of years. The land grants was fought by the South, obviously, and they overthrew Reconstruction in a violent way through terrorism and violence. And Reconstruction fails. Johnson vetoes it. But instead, the freed slaves get a bank, a savings bank. So they get the Freedmen's Savings Bank. And so, oh, you know, we're not going to give you land, but you can get the savings account and save your way into land. What happens is that the savings account, you know, and freed slaves do save in the bank. There's millions of dollars, you know, billions in today's money comes into this bank from the freed slaves. And the white managers of the bank essentially take the money and speculate it on railroad bonds and lose half of the deposits. And then in the civil rights era, you know, when after the Civil Rights Act are passed, the Voting Rights Act, and black activists are starting to say, both Martin Luther King and, you know, the Black Power movement are saying, we need economic justice, right? So either integration or reparations. And what does Nixon respond with but black banks and black capitalism? And this is the history that I've covered. It's an important history because, and by the way, once Nixon says that, every president post-Nixon responds to the wealth gap through, you know, black business, black banks. And of course, now we don't call it that. We call it community development or community enterprise. Donald Trump last week, in one of his least controversial actions as president, you know, deemed October 24th, whatever last week was, or 2 weeks ago, as Minority Enterprise Business Week. And every president since Nixon has done this. And this is just this, you know, policy band-aid thing that, you bring a few minority executives and give them awards and, you know, sort of bolster these financial success stories and pretend like that's the appropriate response to the racial wealth gap. So I've uncovered this history, and it's a cynical, kind of ugly picture, but not to say that everyone engaged in it is doing it. I mean, there's a lot of community organizations that are doing very, very good work, and black banks are doing very good work, but there are also policies that were rooted in a cynical response that was a decoy to other meaningful reform. And that's what I try to focus on in the book.
So what do we do?
What do is we bone up on our history. We learn what happened. I mean, I'm a bookworm and a professor, right? So I say read, figure out what happened and why it happened. So dig into this history and understand it and get political power. I mean, I think the one of the lessons of this history of the racial wealth gap is this idea that, policies create wealth. Federal policies, banks are not these private entities. They're very much public utilities. And so we need to get political power. We, as in a coalition of people who can force change, right? Not just black, but, you know, all of us, and understanding that what kind of political action and targeting this economic, these economic policies, right? Don't look away from things that seem too, you know, taxi or banky or, you know, econ-y, but like really just focus on those things. So as activists and as professors and as voters, we really need to be paying attention to the policies that always go under the radar. I mean, most people look up, you know, once there's a big crisis, but then most of the other time they look away. And I think we really need to figure out what our policymakers are doing as it relates to banks, as it relates to taxes. And what we have currently is a corrupt and regressive tax system. We've got a corrupt and regressive banking regulatory system. We have, you know, five or six big banks that control the market. I've advocated a push for public banking, so a public option. I've talked about postal banks being used as a way to give, you know, small savers and small borrowers access to banking, sort of trying to cut these payday lenders and check cashers.
Can we talk about that? The post office used to be a bank, right?
The post office was a bank from 1910 until 1966 and gave a lot of, you know, immigrants and black communities and just, you know, low-income individuals across the country a place to just have your money. Which is huge, right? If you can have this, you know, $500 or $600 or $1,000 to save in a postal bank, which banks don't want your small savings. They will give you overdraft fees and all sorts of checking fees if you don't have enough money, if you're not rich. So, you know, poor people don't have a place to save their money that is secure and safe. And so if you have that $500 or whatever, next time you have an emergency, you won't need that payday loan. So just giving people a place to park their money and save it is a huge boon that would, you know, cut some of these check cashers, especially out of the market, right? So then you get your checkbooks, you can get a debit card and not pay 10% of your income just to cash your check. So that's immediately, you know, putting money back in the pockets of, you know, everyday sort of low-income Americans. Otherwise, we could talk about public banking in a bigger way, you know, talk about how can we get loans, cutting out banks as a middleman, right? A lot of the credit comes from these federal government programs. Why do we need banks, you know, scooping up profits from that and really only serving the wealthy? We need, a way to get that credit into the pockets of low-income Americans, get them wealth, create wealth-building loans, not just subprime loans, which is how usually low-income communities are courted by the financial markets. And then as far as the wealth gap, I mean, look, we know how to create middle-class wealth in America, and it's through mortgage guarantees, it's through low-cost student loans, it's through all of these programs that we did during the New Deal in the true progressive era. But that time, the 1934 New Deal programs were built on white supremacy. In order for FDR to get his New Deal passed in the Senate, which was controlled by the Southern Bloc, he had to cut blacks out of it. And we need a new New Deal that doesn't do that, and in fact reverses those gains and really focuses on black wealth. I think that is historically justified to just reverse those programs and just pump in money into those redlined communities because we really, or credit. And then there's a way to do it that it's not costly. You know, the New Deal was not costly. Everyone gained and the public coffers were actually filled with the creation of a new middle class. So it doesn't have to be, you know, some suck of public money.
Now, one of the last things before we talk about the books that you've written, you know, when I talk to people, there are some people, especially white people, who feel like they would be losing in this equation, that it would be some redistribution of their, quote, their wealth that would be necessary to bring everybody to a point where there was equity. What do you say to that?
I think it's not a zero sum, right? So that's what we need to understand here is that pockets of poverty actually hinder all of our economic growth. I mean, there's been studies on this, right? The more the economic inequality there is, it's a drag on the large scale. And so I think, you know, bringing people up to a middle class living standard actually does benefit everyone just economically, right? Getting, you know, our failing schools and other things that are, you know, sort of this drain on public resources, getting more home ownership. I mean, it doesn't have to be home ownership, but some sort of capital ownership actually boosts everyone's bottom line. But I also think, I'm okay with benefits going just to people who are not me. And we have to be, as a society, okay with that. Because if you look at this history, and this is what I've tried to untangle in the book, is from the beginning of this country and until today, economic benefits have gone to white communities. And this is what privilege looks like, white privilege looks like in the economic sense, right? We have purposefully, redistributed wealth to whites or upwards. We have been doing wealth redistribution. We have been doing social engineering, but it hasn't been the way that people think it is. It's been to white communities through these New Deal era programs. And you could read about it in the book, but the way we talk about it tends to be this backwards way of, oh, it's the welfare recipients that are taking public money. And welfare is just a drop in the bucket compared to all of the other subsidies that go to the wealthy and the middle class. So look, I mean, I think, and this is where I say the remedy is to just know more. Because the less you know, the more likely you are to blame the wrong people for the wrong things.
And can you talk about the books that you've written and where can people find more information about you and about those books?
Yeah, so I have written the How the Other Half Banks, but the one that I just wrote is The Color of Money. And I think if you're going to pick one, pick The Color of Money, because I think that's where I talk about the history of the racial wealth gap and try to really connect how the wealth gap is created and the problems that has sort of, you know, created in tandem with the wealth gap, and also how politics have played into that. And it's
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Story that goes from the Civil War until today, and it really, I try to connect a lot of different strands of thought in this area and paint a full picture of what's happened and what we need to do to remedy that. And you can find me on Twitter, but, you know, don't come find me in my house.
And where can people find you on Twitter?
I'm at Marissa Baradaran. It's a hard name, but MERSABARADARAN.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being able to talk to us from Pod Save the People. We consider you a friend of the pod, and we'll have you back soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
And now my conversation with David Kamen, former special assistant to President Obama for economic policy.
David Kamen, thank you so much for joining us on Pod Save the People today.
My pleasure. Thank you. It's great to be back.
Okay, so can you tell us what is happening with this tax proposal from the Republicans?
Sure. So right now there are two tax proposals from the Republicans, one in the House and one in the Senate. They have introduced both in just the last couple of weeks, giving people only days to read the legislation before trying to put it through committee. They are rushing the bills, trying to get them done and even on the president's desk for signature by December. So we're right now in crunch time, and the bills are long. They are complicated. They disproportionately benefit some of the richest Americans and have a lot of complicated provisions. And it's between now and December, which may decide whether these things become law or not.
And what are the differences between the two plans? Or should we be equally worried about both of them? Or is there one that we should be more worried about? Are either of them good?
So the two plans, which they are going to end up having to reconcile, have the same basic frame to them. They are different in some important respects, but they do have the same basic frame to them, which is they have very large rate cuts for business income, and especially the business income of some of the largest corporations and businesses. So both of them feature a large reduction in the corporate tax rate from the current rate of 35% to 20%. Both of them feature a new special lower rate for other kinds of businesses. Businesses that work what are often called through pass-throughs, where the business income gets taxed on someone's individual tax return. And there's an especially large loophole in the House version of the tax bill, which provide very large benefits to people at the top of the income distribution, but both feature a loophole for those kinds of businesses. Now, they also have some modest tax cuts for low and middle income families. Some of those families might even see immediate tax increases starting in 2018. But for families, especially with just taking a standard deduction, who aren't itemizing and so on, they do give some small tax cuts. But those tax cuts tend to dissipate with time. And even for some of their families, including their big example family, would turn into a tax increase, for instance, under the House plan. So bottom line, some differences, a lot of similarities. Big similarity is that these are tax cuts disproportionately focused on big corporations, and which tend to disproportionately benefit the top of the income distribution.
And can you just explain the corporate tax? Like, what is why does the corporate tax matter? Like, what does it mean that it's being cut this way? Like, why should people care about that? Like, I don't think I've ever heard about corporate taxes until this moment.
So corporate taxes are important because some of the largest businesses in America pay tax to the government that way. So we raise hundreds of billions of dollars right now through the corporate tax. It's not the largest source of revenue for the government, but it is an important source of revenue. And it's a source of revenue that most economists think really ends up being paid by the owners of the companies. And the owners of the companies tend to be people with money to own the companies, tend to be disproportionately some of the highest income Americans. So it's important because it raises money. It's important because it's a source of revenue from some of the highest income Americans. And finally, it's also important because the corporate tax provides a backstop to the regular income tax that we have. And if you get rid of it, if you cut it too much, it can allow a way for high income Americans to potentially shove money into corporations to try to avoid taxation. So it's important for a range of reasons. And look, there are some parts of the corporate system which do probably deserve reform. We don't tax in some of the best ways, especially when it comes to the ways that our multinational businesses get taxed. But bottom line, this is a progressive revenue source, and they're going to be cutting it a lot in both bills. It's part of the reason why both bills end up disproportionately benefiting some of the richest Americans.
We talked before, and one of the things you said is that the cuts are going to bring down the revenue so dramatically, but not change anything with the spending, and that this will allow the Republicans in a couple of years to just cut programs because they'll be like, there's just not enough money because they've actually decreased the revenue through these massive tax cuts. Do you still think that's the case, that that's their plan?
Yes, and that is, I think that is their plan. I think they're pretty explicit that that is their plan. So these tax cuts in both versions of them reduce revenues by $1.5 trillion over the next decade. Now, they will claim that those tax cuts mean that everyone wins. Now, first off, it's important to recognize that everyone doesn't win, even in what is written into the very legislation. So, for instance, in 2027, under the plan that the House put forward, 96 million Americans making less than $200,000 a year would, by that point, see no tax cut or a tax increase. And that's even as those making over $1 million would see a tax cut averaging about $100,000 per household. So, you know, even then, so even written into the plans are either no tax cuts or tax increases on many middle income families. Now, looking out ahead, it's important to recognize that that's even as that plan adds really significantly to the deficit. And step two of the strategy is to then say, with a $1.5 trillion added to the deficit, it will be even more urgent to reduce the deficit by cutting programs like Medicare, like Medicaid, perhaps even Social Security, and then in that way, financing those deficits, financing the tax cuts by a reduction in some of the programs that are key to low and middle income Americans, and also investments that help grow the economy. And it's in their own budget. So their own budgets that they voted on have those very kinds of cuts outlined in them. Now, they've separated it so that they voted on their budget that have those cuts in them, but then they set up the process so that they did the tax cuts first and separated from the spending cuts. They've sort of learned from what happened with healthcare reform, but in that one of the things that tripped them up was that they tried to put together the tax cuts that they wanted and the spending cuts that were going to finance it and kick people off healthcare. In this case, they're trying to do tax cuts only, and then later on would return and say, look, we have these big new deficits that are even larger than they were before, and we've got to cut back key programs. So I do think that's almost explicitly the strategy of the Republican Party right now.
Like, is there not another way they could inflict sort of their agenda? Like, why are taxes the site that they're fighting over?
So they're fighting over taxes because for high-income Americans and corporations, this is a significant way that they, you know, they pay money into the government, and that we finance some of our key transfer programs that often the Republicans don't like, and also key investments that they often oppose. And so I think it's, you know, probably a few things there. And, you know, and as I said, it starts off with the fact that we do have a progressive federal tax system. The system at the state level is less so, but for the federal government, high-income Americans and corporations do contribute a significant amount of money, even as they make a large share of income in the country. And I think they'd like to reduce that. And they'd also like to reduce what the government does, including some of the basic programs that help low and middle income Americans. And again, some of the investments we make. And so it's a twofer. If you manage to cut back government revenues, including especially the amounts that corporations and high income Americans are paying, and also then later able to ramp back some of the programs they dislike, I think that's why they're so focused. It's pretty central to what they believe. And look, I think some of them honestly believe that somehow, you know, taxes really slow down the economy, and these programs and that provide safety nets do as well. Others may be answerable to their donors. In any case, this for them is pretty central to their economic agenda.
Now, what are some of the other lesser known provisions of their proposals? The corporate tax cut gets a lot of play. I thought I saw something about taking away money for teachers buying supplies, or something about loans for school. Do you know anything about those parts?
I do. Especially in the House plan, but both feature some things that are like this. But in the House plan, especially, you see this really stark line drawn between owners of firms who are given all kinds of tax preferences, and which a lot of them are retained, and employees who get things taken away from them. So, for instance, in the House plan, they get rid of a lot of deductions that employees can take that are actually real cost to them of being an employee. That includes the $250 above the line write-off that teachers can take for supplies that they buy for their classrooms. But it also includes a bunch of other employee expenditures that are right now actually probably too limited. For instance, we right now allow a limited deduction for the union dues that workers pay. Those dues should probably be fully deductible, just like when a business pays its lawyers to negotiate with union representatives, they get to take a full write-off. But right now, union dues are partially deductible by the employees who pay them. The House would completely get rid of that deduction. So I think you see this really sort of stark separation where owners can continue to write off those kinds of expenditures, and employees are treated really differently. And things like union dues become entirely non-deductible under the House plan, even as businesses both get a rate cut and could continue writing off when they pay their lawyers to represent them in those kinds of negotiations.
And is there any change to the earned income tax credit? I know before you talked about the earned income tax credit being the single biggest cash assistance that we give to low-income people in the country.
Yeah.
I think I said that correctly. Is there any change to that?
So one important change they make that would be something that has an effect that builds over time is they slow down the annual inflation adjustment that's supposed to adjust for the increased cost of living each year. And that's something that has a small change each year, but it's one that builds over time. And so you, of course, have to look at it in the full context of the bill. But especially on the House side, there was basically nothing for low-income families. On the Senate side, there's some little things for low-income families. But a change like that can have increasing effects over time, so that once you get out a few years, you can begin to see tax increases on those families that can become somewhat significant, as this program that, you know, previously would have adjusted for cost of living a bit faster ends up going more slowly. And so it's just reflecting the fact, especially with the House bill, there was nothing done basically for the lowest income families, even as they seem to slow down the inflation adjustment for what is one of the most important support programs for the lowest income families.
What are the questions that we should be asking as this unfolds?
So, you know, I think it's really important to ask what this bill is going to do to help low-income and middle-income working families in this country. And I think it's important for people to make sure that politicians are held to account, that they aren't allowed to get away with funny math and magic thinking, saying that cutting taxes dramatically on corporations and deficit financing that will be what helps middle-class families, because the benefits will somehow trickle down as, you know, corporations will do, you know, invest in ways that help families. That's not what the economic evidence suggests. Yes, there are ways to reform corporate taxes that could potentially do some good, but not when it's a dramatic cut that is deficit financed and likely to actually go the wrong direction, reduce economic growth. So I think it's asking, what is this going to do for families? How is it going to do that? And making sure that the Republicans cannot get away with essentially a bait and switch, where they offer some relatively modest tax cuts for some working families and eventually phase that down relative to much larger tax cuts for corporations and high-income Americans that will eventually lead to programs being cut that are more, that are really important for low-income and middle-income families. So really, as I said, I think it's holding them to account and making sure that the rhetoric they're saying, because they're going to say that this helps middle-income families. They're going to say middle-class families come away as winners. And it's making sure that that rhetoric is actually backed up with reality. And right now, under both plans, it's not.
Boom. Well, David, thanks so much for joining today. How can people find you?
Sure. So they can find me on Twitter at David C. Kamin, K-A-M-I-N. And I'm also posting a good amount to Medium, and I try to also get that out through Twitter as well.
And where can they find you on Medium? You're David Kamin?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you so much, David. I appreciate it. We can't wait to have you back to give us another update on what's happening with taxes.
All right. Thanks so much, DeRay. Real pleasure to join you.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People. Please tell a friend. Make sure that you rate it wherever you get your podcasts, and I'll see you next week.